This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers. Today we're sponsored by BDoc's Timeline 3D, which is a great iOS and Mac app for creating and presenting timelines on iPads, iPhones, iPod Touches and your Mac. We'll tell you more about that as the show goes on. Evening, Bradley. How are you?
I'm fantastic. We are 2 days in back from spring break. It is still freezing in Chattanooga. I don't really know that it can be considered spring break when we had snow flurries a few days over my break. I think we should get a redo.
Yeah, that doesn't count as spring in my book.
Well, it's funny. Chattanooga just historically doesn't get a lot of snow. But back in 1993, we had a blizzard in late March. And, of course, we haven't had a big, really big snow since then, so people still talk about it. So every year at this time, people always talk about, hey, remember, we got, you know, snow this late in the year, a lot of snow. Of course, it's, you know, 2013, so it's actually been 20 years, so they've been talking about it. Again, that's the kind of thing, it shows that we just don't get much snow.
Yep, yep. And, of course, no equipment to deal with it when you do.
Well, no, we literally shut down school if there's, like, the threat of ice because the city just doesn't have the capabilities to deal with that. It's funny. I was at Costco a few days ago, and which is, like, a big wholesale place here in the States, and talking to a lady about it, and she said, I don't guess you were born then. It's like, how old do I look? That was only 20 years ago. That was in third grade. It's quite funny.
You're not quite old enough to thank her for that.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm not quite old enough to thank her, but not quite young enough to really to understand. Of course, I had my son with me at the time. So I don't know what, never mind.
Do the math, as they say. All right, cool. I guess one thing that's pertinent to our interest that happened, I guess, today was the new release of Hive Manager, which is the online control part of the AeroHive system. We haven't upgraded ours yet. I understand you've upgraded part of your stuff so far.
Yeah, I put a request in early this morning with tech support to have my Hive Manager online account upgraded. And so they did that within a few hours. And then I tweeted about it earlier, but it's the game I call the access point roulette, where I, throughout the day, you know, let's say if our third grade classes are either at lunch or at recess, there will be zero clients on their access points that are in the classrooms. So I'll take that point to push out the new firmware and reboot the access point, and no one ever knows. And so it was, I've been kind of watching that all day as classrooms go to lunch, pushing out the configuration. So I've been working on that today. And then the rest of them that are more general purpose areas that generally serve clients all day, I have pushed the firmware, but they're just set to reboot tonight. And then if you've not used AeroHive's network management system before, which is Hive Manager, when you upgrade firmware, you then have to push a complete configuration again to the access point for it to see any new changes that you've done after a firmware upgrade. And so tomorrow I will go ahead and push a new configuration to all the access points, have them reboot at midnight again, and then I'll be able to start, having the more visibility into my network. I haven't made any changes as far as the application control goes, which is the layer 7, in the OSI model, the application layer. You know, I haven't started tinkering with that. What I'll probably do is kind of make a test SSID and try to, I guess, more mess around with it, see how it works and things like that.
So these are some of the features that we sort of previewed a couple of weeks ago when the announcement first came out. The idea that, I guess one of the big features in this release is that you can now look at traffic going past in terms of packet inspection and looking at exactly what these packets constitute going across your network. So whether they're YouTube packets or whether they're Skype, I guess, or various other high-level internet applications, you can start to break down the data traffic all across your whole network, but also per client, I guess, as well. To see who's busy on what.
Yeah, one of the things that's in the release notes as a bug that they're not able to detect Netflix streams all of the time. And that makes sense because that does seem hard to catch because they probably use so many different content delivery networks. But again, that was listed as a bug, so I'm sure that'll be fixed at some point. So if you're wanting to get your account upgraded, if you're a you know, ArrowHive has their Hive Manager online service where it's a hosted instance of your network manager system. If you have that, you can just log a ticket with tech support if you deal with directly with through ArrowHive, or if you go through a partner, you can open up a ticket with your partner and they'll upgrade you now. If you just wait around, eventually you will be upgraded at some point, I believe. I think that the idea is eventually to get everybody on 6.0, but I think they kind of, well, actually, maybe not. Now that I think about it, you may have to request it, because I think ArrowHive's one of their things is that you control when you're kind of your software is upgraded. So now that I think about it, but, and so they'll put in a request, they'll upgrade you, and then you can kind of go through the process of, upgrading the firmware and things like that.
We haven't upgraded ours. I haven't requested to be upgraded yet, because this is kind of the first time since we got our ArrowHive kit that we've had a new Hive Manager release that we wanted to move to. So what I'm going to do, I think, on Thursday with our ArrowHive engineer in the UK, who is a bit of a rock star. His name is Ben Wilson. I know he listens. Hi, Ben. Thank you for your help. he and I are going to get together on Thursday over Skype or something, and he's going to walk me through that, which is great, because it's a fairly bit major change. You know, it's not changing it anyway is a deal, and then going to a major new release is also a whole other level of interest. But the timing is great for us, because we just went on holiday. Yesterday was the first day of 2 weeks of holiday for us, so we work on it this week and then get the kinks worked out of it next week, and then we should be in good shape by the time we come back.
One of the things I kind of alluded to, if I didn't mention, like, you know, along with doing Hive Manager online, you can run Hive Manager on an appliance internally or on a VMware instance. And so if you have those, you can actually log into the support download section of ArrowHive support website and actually go ahead and download all of the firmware you would need to upgrade. I encourage you to read the release notes, because if you're doing some things locally, you just need to be aware of some processes and steps. But this will be my second, I guess, major upgrade with ArrowHive. We started with 4 dot something back over a year ago, and then we moved to 5 pretty quickly because it came out, you know, rather quickly. It's really a seamless process. They got some great things built in where, let's say for whatever reason, the firmware update didn't take, it keeps the previous one in memory. And so if it detects something is wrong, it'll just revert back to the old one.
Yeah, I've seen that in action a couple of times when I've screwed up configurations. it'll do that for configuration as well. I think if your configuration sort of changes result in it not being able to contact the internet again, it'll roll back.
Yeah.
If I'm right about that.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's a great feature. I mean, even the most seasoned network professional screws up on occasion.
Yes, we have all locked ourselves out of computer by playing with firewall rules from a remote computer at some point in our careers. And then had to get in the car and drive to wherever the computer was and fix it then.
True story. A few weeks ago after the show, I actually had locked myself in my office. Thankfully, people are still here. Because I mentioned that I have a closet now, and so I record in that closet. Well, the lock, it locks from the outside, and there's no way, like the way the handle is, it's just, there's not a way to unlock it from the inside. And so I didn't have my keys with me. And so thankfully somebody was still on campus and I had my iPhone. But yeah, I was locked in my closet.
You don't have a box of power bars in your bottom drawer just for such an eventuality?
I do not. Thankfully, I had Wi-Fi though.
Oh, well, you're set. Flat food coming under the floor. Just like, yeah. Have you read Generation X, Douglas Copeland?
No.
As a feature of that book is people in startup companies being locked in their rooms and in their offices until they finish the project they're working on. And all they can get to eat is food that is flat and can be pushed under the door. That could be our lives at some point.
Yeah, that is very true. Very true. Yeah, it's funny, being in education, you end up wearing so many hats. And I do a lot of emailing out to parents just because it's a kind of a, you know, just a process. You just don't want to screw that up. And so I usually will do a lot of the kind of mass emails to parents. Well, we have field day in May. Like, it's kind of like an outdoor activity day. So they always have field day shirts. So I was sending out an email to our parents today with the order form for the shirts and the example. And I tell you, I really stress about typing the word shirt in an email. Because if you screw that up, that is a drastically different word.
Yeah, and public.
Yeah, and going to 300 families, that was very, very much stresses me out. So I literally read that email about 10 times and then had someone else read it as well.
You got to know what's safety critical in your operation.
What's that?
emailing parents.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's your number one thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's hey. In education, you just wear a lot of hats. You know, I'm the mover of boxes and mm-hmm. lots of things.
Well, one of the things I'm currently involved in is I'll explain why later on in the show. We'll talk about why we're doing this, but one of the things we're doing at the moment is collecting old technology for recycling for fundraising. So one of my jobs, actually, this was part of a class we were teaching. There's a class. A new course in Scotland called Administration and IT that we're teaching for the first time. And one of the things that's in that course is it emphasizes kind of hands-on learning. So one of the projects, and you're supposed to kind of design projects that the kids can sort of do. And then as a result of doing these projects, they kind of build up the skills that they're supposed to have. So one of the projects we had them working on was basically helping out with their iPad refresh. Because there's kind of lots of moving parts to that and lots of administration and there's some documentation to be produced and then there's events to organize and different things. So we're just having the class kind of work on that. And one of the things we had them doing was we spent a whole double period just with two big boxes of old mobile phones and sorting them into ones that worked and ones that didn't work and then cataloging them and all this kind of stuff. Because I think you mentioned last week or the week before that you were going to use Gazelle for some of your off-lease equipment?
Yes, we actually had a call scheduled today and ended up having to reschedule it.
So we're doing a similar thing with that. One of the mobile phone carriers in the UK, O2, they offer recycling services and also they'll do a kind of thing where they match however much you raise in terms of, for schools this is, however much you raise in terms of the stuff that you bring in, they'll match it up to something like £1,000, which is quite generous of them. So we're going to take advantage of some of that. Although we found that when we asked people to hand in their old electronic equipment, a lot of it came in broken or missing a battery or missing a charger or something like that. So a lot of it didn't actually qualify for what you can send back to them. But we got some stuff that did. So we're going to box that up pretty soon.
Did you ever have one of those Nokia phones that you could change the faceplate on?
Yes, I did.
I certainly did. That was such a classic phone. I just remember like being in high school when that was out, and you know that was the big thing is you would go buy a new faceplate like with your favorite sports team on it. I just remember that, and I guess nowadays that's like the iPhone case is.
Yeah, you just clip that on the back now, don't you? Was that the 3210? Was that the design?
Yeah, it was something like that.
It may have had a different name in the US, I'm not sure, but I think that's what's called over here.
It was just amazing to me like how Nokia, yeah, I know they're really big over in Europe, but they were big for such a short time in the US. And it kind of went from that to the Razr, and then of course from then it went to the Blackberries and iPhones and whatnot. But like when I was in high school, like that was the big phone. Everybody wanted that phone, and it had Snake on it, so you had a lot of games you could play.
And then was there not a version of Snake later on that you could play two-player over infrared?
Oh, yeah. And of course, it never worked.
Yeah, somebody would get excited and move it a fraction and the beam would break and that would be it. Yeah. Nokia, yeah. I mean, Nokia were huge over here back in the day. But you mentioned kind of American cell phones and stuff, and it was always really interesting to me when I first started going to the U.S. on a regular basis, which I guess was sort of 1999, 2000, 2001. Like how old fashioned American phones were. Like people's mobile phones were just, they were stuff that we in Europe had like 4 years ago. And that was the stuff that Americans were still buying. And I guess one of the most interesting things in the past sort of 5 to 6 years has been how America is now leading the world in mobile technology, LTE, and also just the phones that are coming out, I guess. And obviously, NTT Docomo was big in Japan for a certain amount of time, but now I guess iPhone, Android are really just leading the way, coming out of America and leading the way across the world, which is really interesting.
We're supposed to have LTE launching on AT&T here any day in my city. All the cities around us have it, and then Verizon already has it in my city. And so like when I've traveled to even 30 minutes south, I'm on LTE, and it's really amazing. I mean, it really feels like you're on Wi-Fi.
I was actually discussing this with a class the other day. We were looking at, there's one operator in the UK that is selling LTE speeds at the moment, which is a company called EE, which is the merger of Orange and T-Mobile in the UK and Europe, I guess. And they're claiming to have it in Greenock at the moment. They certainly got it in Glasgow and Edinburgh in Scotland. and they're claiming to have it weekly in our town as well. But at the moment, because of a kind of, and I'm going to get this wrong technically, but basically all the networks in the UK had a they had a frequency that they could test their 4G services on, and then it just so turned out that EE were the company who had the same frequency as was actually going to be the production frequency in the UK. So they got a 6 to 8 month jump on everybody else in selling 4G services. Now in time, everybody's going to get 4G services, but at the moment it's only one company you can get it from. So the price is just astronomical compared to what you can get 3G for. So I'm sitting on my hands on that one just now, but sooner or later that's all going to come, I guess.
Well, what's bad here in the States from a marketing perspective, it's gotten so confusing that I actually have 4G with AT&T, but all that really is 3G plus. So there's 3G and there's 4G and then there's LTE. So I've been on 4G since I was on the iPhone 4S. Like all of a sudden with a software update, it just said 4G. And of course, I still had people asking me, hey, do we get LTE? I said, no. So it's just 3G plus is all it was. It was just a faster standard of 3G. And it just, all that is very confusing to consumers as well.
It's doubly confusing when you go from Europe where your phone says 3G and the same phone when you get off the plane on the other side says 4G. Like, oh, where, did I get an upgrade?
Yeah. On the plane? Yeah, it's really confusing. Our 4G service has been so bad in this city for the past month, I guess. It's really unusable for me outside of Wi-Fi. And I've been told by folks that that is a symptom of them doing a lot of replacing of antennas and things like that to prepare for LTE, that the kind of the lower speeds suffer during that time.
Yeah, I guess there's going to be a transitional period, isn't there? And I guess there's also going to be a period where the service is just much more expensive just because all the gear's got to get paid for somehow.
Now, I'm not going to put a link to this in the show notes because it is sort of vulgar, but there's a comic here in the U.S. His name is Louis C.K., and he's kind of known for being the first guy that started on comedy to do like direct to consumer, where he like sold for $5 like an unencrypted movie file of his last concert.
Yeah, I heard about that. Yeah.
So he has a topic on cell phones. And again, if you watch it, it's highly vulgar. But he talks about how we're like the worst generation to have these amazing phones. That all we do is complain about our phones. So we all talk about how bad our phones are. And we just complain about them. And then if it's slow, we like, oh, this thing's so slow. Then he's like, look, guys, it's going to space. Give it a second. And it really is true. I mean, I'm sitting here complaining that my iPhone is too slow outside. I mean, it really is just like, give it a second.
It's only got all the world's knowledge. You can wait for that.
Right. Yeah. Of course, somebody told me a joke once that if you told someone 30 years ago that we had the entire world's knowledge in the palm of our hands and we use it to watch cat videos, that they would not believe us.
Yeah. All those careers in the space program and everything in science, and this is what we do with it.
Yeah.
Shame on us.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll survive.
Still, we will. We'll invent something better. Right. So, topic for tonight. I guess the main thing we're going to talk about is a sort of progress update on where we are with our iPad refresh, which I've been working on for a couple of months. Some decisions have been made. Some decisions are still to be made. This is the point. When Donald Rumsfeld made that quote about there are known knowns and there are known unknowns and there are unknown unknowns and all that kind of stuff, loads of people made fun of him, but anybody who's run a project in technology knew exactly what he was talking about. And so there are some things we know. We know roughly the size of the device we want to get. We have some known unknowns in that we haven't decided certain things, but we know we have to decide them, such as whether we go 16 gigs or 32. And there are unknown unknowns, which are things like how is the new deployment model going to work out? And there are some of those things we're working on. So to give you a kind of idea of where we are, back in January, we started talking to resellers here in the UK, some based in, or at least have a heavy presence in Scotland and others more down in England. But we started talking to them about what the prices might look like for new devices. And the first thing that jumped out at me when we looked at that was that the cost to lease iPads today is substantially less than what we're paying for on the current lease that's about to expire for our iPad 1s. So despite going from first generation iPads to Retina display iPads with Lightning connectors and A6X processors and so on, we're going to end up paying less than we did last time, which is awesome. Helps the school substantially. And I don't want to give out the exact prices that we've been quoted because those are sort of commercially confidential, but we're looking at about a 20 to 25% reduction in our leasing payments over what we were paying over the last 3 years for our iPads. So that's pretty nice.
I think that's the key for everybody to remember is, you know, it's for us buying in bulk like this, it's not about necessarily driving down the cost of the iPad, which Apple doesn't do very much. It's all about the leasing terms. And, you know, we just don't buy much stuff anymore. Anytime we can lease something, we will, because we know it'll have to be replaced. And from a cash flow perspective, that is so important.
Yeah, our iPads were the first thing that we ever leased. Historically, we'd always bought the equipment that we needed for the school. And partly that was doable because we're typically not buying that much equipment. You know, it was, you know, 12 iMacs or something, or one Xserve or something. But going up to this number of devices, leasing was the only way we could kind of get into it. And I think leasing has served as well. I mean, we're having a debate at the moment about whether previously we leased a case and an iPad for everybody. And one of the debates we're having right now is whether we lease a case again, or we buy a case, or we just push that problem off to other people. But we'll talk about that in a little minute. But it's interesting that one of the things I noticed when we looked at those leasing prices was that there's two factors in it, right? There's the cost of, there's the actual per unit cost of the iPad, and then there's the cost, the leasing payment, right? And what we noticed, we got quotes from all the resellers we could find. And what we noticed was that some resellers who were giving us a really good price on the device itself, when you rolled that into the quarterly lease cost, the lease payment was actually more than it was with another reseller who were charging us actually more for the iPad, but they were taking their margin off the lease. So I guess one of the things to kind of bear in mind is that finance is a product just like the iPad is a product, and there's a margin to be made on both sides, right? So sometimes what you'll see is that people will, they'll cut themselves to the bone on the price of the device, and then they'll try and make it up a little bit on the finance product that you're getting to in order to make the lease happen, whereas other people might even out a bit, and you may end up paying less over the piece for a lease from people who are actually not charging you, or are actually charging you more for the iPad than other people who might be cutting the cost of the device but making it back up in the lease. So that's something to bear in mind if you're getting involved in that.
So you guys don't lease directly through Apple then?
We did last time. Yep. So the first lease we ever did, I basically went to the Genius Bar at the Apple Store and said, I'd like to speak to the business team. And the business team guy came down and I said, look, I want to lease some equipment. And he's like, great, we lease equipment here. What would you like? I said, iPads. And he's like, In fact, his first words were, I don't think we lease iPads. And I was like, that's going to be a problem. So in fact, basically what happened was that they hadn't organized the leasing of iPads by that point at all. But in the end, we just ended up with a standard business equipment lease from Apple for the full retail cost of iPad 1s, which is back in the day was £429 per device in the UK. So we rolled in the iPad and the standard Apple iPad case. And leased that entire set of equipment over 3 years. So at full retail price, not even, you know, with discounts or whatever, and paying the standard Apple financial cost of the lease. And that's been our structure since then. And now obviously we're looking at going through resellers rather than back through the Apple store, because the resellers are a lot more competitive and can change their margins, I guess, more dramatically. The margins such as they are in the iPad, one of the things we've also learned from looking at this is there's not actually a lot of difference between the resellers in terms of how much they're charging for the device itself. Really, the margins on iPads are pretty slim, and what you what gets played with is things like the margin on the finance product and the margin on things like cases and additional services that resellers can add to make the whole deal more valuable to you.
Yeah, that's interesting because we have to buy directly through Apple. Like, I cannot go to a reseller and use my school tax exempt card and buy something.
Right.
And it's interesting to see that Apple has kind of different policies for different countries.
Yeah, as far as I understand it, and I may be getting this slightly wrong, but my sense is that all of UK and Europe and so on is kind of works through resellers. And the US is kind of distinct in that Apple has much more direct sales operation to schools in the US than they do here. So at the moment, like, I could go and talk to my Apple contacts, but they wouldn't actually be able to make a deal with me. They would say, if you want to buy stuff, you got to go and talk to my guy at the reseller or one of the resellers or whatever. Whereas in the US, obviously, you can go direct to Apple.
But
have to indeed.
The terms are really still the same because when you're negotiating with them, if you're buying AppleCare, they have a lot more room to kind of wiggle on the negotiating because they can take it off the margins of the AppleCare, which is probably an incredible margin. But since we don't buy those, we really don't get much off the list price, if any, because they just, internally want to lower the price that much. And we're still going to buy them. I mean, they really are in a great business. They're not competing against anybody, I guess, for our business. I mean, we're not every 3 years, we weren't considering Dell this time for any products. We weren't considering HP. And so that really shows that for us, it's less about, saving $1,000 off a lease price as much as it is like, this is a product that we can trust and that we can use and we can manage and deploy. So it's worth paying, a premium for that.
Yeah. And I think also from a reseller's point of view, dealing with Cedars is probably not, how can I put this? We're not a good reseller people, and partly that's because we have much more expertise within the school than most schools would have. So typically what a reseller would do is they would put together, here's the price for your devices and here's all the Apple TVs you're going to get and here's all the support we're going to give you in this package and that package and all of these professional development days and so on. And I'm kind of going to them and going, well, just give me iPads, right? I'll do the rest. and they don't really have an opportunity with us to put other things around it that make it into an attractive business package for them, which I guess is perhaps to our detriment, but it is the way it is, unfortunately.
And we run into the same boat. I have vendors call us all the time and they want to sell us, these, I guess, labor-filled solutions. And we really, for the most part, don't really hire many folks for stuff. I usually am just buying equipment. If there are things I can't do, like if we want to install something that I can't do, we'll just buy a complete package from someone. But we don't do that either. Like I don't, we don't buy the professional development days from Apple. We just really do that internally.
Yeah. And of course, what happens sometimes is that resellers actually hire me to go and do the professional development for other people. So we kind of don't have to go down that line.
So could you take vacation from work, let the reseller hire you for the day, and then come in and teach your own faculty?
I never thought of that.
You can take paid vacation. Hey guys, I'm gonna take vacation this week. But you got this trainer coming in, and he's wonderful. Now, at my last job, I worked at a telephone company before I worked here. I've been here almost 4 years. And there was like a lot of they had various wiring guys and things like that that did installations. But they also had a lot of contractors. And it was like very commonplace that guys would take vacation, but then go work the week for the contractors, then working for their own company. So double dip.
God bless America.
They get their vacation pay, but they spent their vacation working for someone else. So I guess that's, obviously teach.
Yeah, that's not uncommon over here either. It's I don't know about in education, I guess.
I like my days off.
I suppose one of the things that happens in education is that people have a career, retire early, and then come back as a consultant for twice the money.
And
tell you how the things that they did when they were in the job are all wrong now and have to do something different.
What's really big over here is we are very close to the state line. Of course, the way the retirement contracts are done, like if you retire in public education in the state of Tennessee, like your retirement is from the state of Tennessee. So what they'll do is like people will retire from Georgia or retire from Tennessee and then go work in Georgia. And like, they're literally, I mean, they're double dipping. I mean, it's like, you know, they go work for 5 or 6 years in Georgia and then retire again. Of course, they don't get any retirement from Georgia, but they basically, you know, basically got double salary for 5 or 6 years.
And that's how you get a holiday house in Florida, right?
Yeah, that is true. Right. I'll actually be going to San Antonio in June to speak in a conference on mobile development, like mobile infrastructure. It's the ISTE 2013 in San Antonio. So if any of the listeners are going to be there, I'll be speaking on a panel on that Monday.
Awesome. I've heard of that event. I've never been to it, but it's a pretty huge event, isn't it, ISTE?
See, if you ever can, if we can ever go to the same conference, we can do a live recording of the show. But then it would be awkward because no one around us would know what we were doing. It would just be two guys sitting there with a microphone.
Yeah, we should figure out how to get that happen. Yeah, so we were talking about leasing there. Yeah. The other thing about leasing is we were offered different kinds of lease, and I don't know if the terminology is the same everywhere in the world, but basically the way they were described to me was what you would call an operating lease and a finance lease. An operating lease being the kind of lease that you're kind of supposed to be on forever, right? Where you lease the equipment for a lower quarterly repayment, and then at the end, the finance company expects to get that equipment back and sell it for its residual value in order to kind of make their money off of the deal, and then you would start another lease for new equipment, right? So it's a kind of perpetual rolling lease where you just get new equipment every 3 years and you keep paying whatever the equipment costs at that 3 year point. The other one being a finance lease, which is where you basically pay the entire cost of the device over the lifetime of the lease, plus a little bit more for the finance company's margin. And then at the end of the lease, you can basically have the equipment for a nominal fee. And that's the kind of lease we've been on up till now, these finance leases. So the operating leases that were being offered this time are substantially cheaper because you're basically saving about the equivalent of between 1 and 2 quarterly payments over the 3 year period of the lease. So the quarterly payments are lower, but at the end of the day, you basically have nothing left in your hand. You just get rid of them and get new things. So we're looking at that model for the next round, just because the quarterly payments are lower. And we know we're going to want new iPads again in 3 years' time. Finance leases are kind of better where you have an expectation of getting maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years out of a product that you'll be paying for 3 years. Whereas at the moment, I still think that these mobile devices, their lifespan is going to be about a 3 year lease, maybe even a bit shorter than that. And perhaps better just to keep on that perpetual upgrade cycle for another couple of generations, and then maybe things will settle down and it will be time to switch to finance leasing. I'm not sure. But we've been on a finance lease up till now. It's been okay, but we can see a saving to be made by going on to operating lease. So I think we're going to do that.
The terminology that you know, most people use over here in the States is dollar buyout or fair market value.
Okay.
So if anybody's listening, that's the terms you may know here in the States.
Cool. And keep doing the transatlantic translation.
Our Aerohive lease was a fair market value because I knew that there would be a new wireless standard in 3 years that would be out, and I would want new gear. And so it was a fair market value. And so at the end of the lease, we can either basically, we have three options. We can keep paying for the equipment, keep paying the lease. We can do a fair market value, which would be a percentage of the equipment. We could then keep it, or we could basically just turn the gear in and do a new lease with new equipment. And that's what we will do. Our Apple lease is the dollar buyout. I was really recommended by our Apple rep that it was better for us to do the dollar buyout, and then they could do a buyback at the end, or we could sell them privately. And we're actually, you know, since a lot of ours were selling privately. And so he said that generally works out better for you at the end. So that's what we're doing.
Yeah, it's all down to what you think the equipment is going to be worth at the end. Because if you can buy it out at the end of your lease for, say, $100 per device, let's say, and you can sell it on the market for $200, then you make $100 per unit over the period. I thought it was pretty hard to estimate that right now for mobile devices. Easier to do it for Macs, absolutely, because they obviously have a much longer lifespan. But you know, do you want to buy an iPad 1 right now?
No, absolutely. I've actually got one. We get some Title I money from the state of Tennessee based on something. And 1 year we bought an iPad 1 with it. And so I can't sell it because it's technically not owned by us. It's technically owned by the state. But we have no use for it. So it's literally sitting in my desk or in my office, and I have no use for it. It's incredibly heavy to actually use as well.
Yeah, we're definitely looking forward to new devices, that's for sure. So one of the other things that we're thinking about in terms of the whole package and everything is cases and protection for the device. And like I mentioned earlier, we put into the leasing payment one Apple iPad case per device. And that's the, if you remember, the black case that came on the first day with the iPad. It was the first case that ever came out. To be fair to those cases, everybody hated them when they first came out, but to be fair to them, they have held up very well for us. I expected that half of them would be dead within the first year, and we have actually only had, I would say, off the top of my head, I've only had two actually split in the sense that they couldn't be used anymore. We've had a few more that have frayed at the edges and stuff, but only maybe another three or four. And most of them are still in pretty good condition, considering their age and the amount of use that those cases have had. So we're obviously not going to use the same case again because it's not suitable for the new devices, but we're looking for something that would do the job. And, I mean, that could be a whole show in itself. It could be a show every week by itself. You know, what's new in iPad cases is, I think, a weekly feature that Macworld run. It's like, here's the 15 iPad cases that came out this week. But anyway, the point being, the question now is whether or not we lease a case for everybody again, or whether we just buy outright a case for everybody, or whether we say, look, we're providing an iPad, but everybody's got to bring your own case. Yeah. And there's some ups and downs on that. I'm not totally, you know, a few months ago, I thought we'll just say everybody bring a case. But then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, oh, I'm not sure that's going to be the right thing to do. And I'll tell you why, is because after we deployed the black iPad case for everybody, some kids asked, can we bring our own case? And we said yes, as long as it sort of folds into a typing stand position and the case closes to cover the screen. What we found was that almost everybody who did that, only I think one person who replaced our case with another case replaced it with a better case than ours. Everybody else replaced it with a cheaper case. And that was fine. Except, well, it was fine for the iPad 1, right? And I don't have data on this, but my intuition is that the iPad 1 is a much more drop-resistant design than any of the later iPads. And I suspect it's because if you look at the iPad 2 and later design, the back tapers off to the edge in such a sharp point, really, that if you manage to drop it right on that edge, that's a tiny, tiny area, and all the force of the drop is going through such a tiny area that some kind of breakage is probably inevitable. Whereas with the iPad 1, you've got that kind of structural wall that goes around the product, and then there's the dished back below it. So there's a lot more area to hit the ground, whichever way you drop it. So my fear is that if we were to let people just bring in any case, we would end up with a lot of cases that weren't going to protect the iPad properly, and our breakage rate would go up. So I started to kind of lean away from the idea of just bring any case, and as long as it fits an iPad 3, you'll be fine. And leaning more towards either saying, bring a case off of this approved list or take our case. That's kind of what I'm thinking about at the moment. But I think probably instead of putting them into the lease, we'll probably just buy everybody a case. And then however many people actually do replace that, we can keep their cases as spares. That's what we did for the past 3 years, and that's worked out pretty well. For those cases that did split or break, I just replaced them with the case of somebody who went out and bought their own case.
Well, it's kind of like the conversations that we've had on bring your own device in the classroom, that if you don't have a baseline, somebody will end up bringing in an incredibly cheap case, just like they would incredibly, you know, inevitably bring in an incredibly cheap, you know, $60 tablets.
Yeah. I mean, there are advantages to people having their own case. And number one is identifiability in the classroom because, the one kid who's got the bright red case, everybody knows whose iPad that is. But then there's 20 black ones. And then you're raking through them trying to look for a label that's probably fallen off. So there are some advantages to that, but at the same time, I think, you know, if you imagine people coming into school just having bought a case, and then you've got to turn around and say, no, that's not good enough, you've got to go and buy another one. You know, they're not going to be very happy with that. So either I think what's going to happen is we will probably provide a case that is up to our standards. I don't know what case that's going to be yet, but there will be one case probably provided by us. And then there will be an approved list of cases that you can replace that with, right? So if you want to replace our case, you're going to have to replace it with something that's at least as good as our case, if not better, but not just something you bought for, you know, $5 down at the mall. I think that's what we're going to do.
I like that idea. You know, give them options. I think that's oftentimes what people want, is just options. So you can kind of limit those options to maybe these five or these three. And what you could do is have affiliate links to an Amazon page to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can be a good fundraiser for you.
Yeah, that could definitely work too. Or there could be, we could actually become a reseller for certain kinds of case. I know a friend of mine who works in a school there in England, they actually sent a guy to China to source an iPad bag for their school that they now use and sell to kids and parents. And that's the kind of thing he does. You know, I have an idea like the one I've just described. He sends a guy to China, you know, he works on a different level. And at a different scale, to be fair. I mean, he's talking about dealing with like 1,100, 1,200 pupils, and I'm dealing with 100, you know, so there's no way I'm getting on a plane to Shenzhen just to find a bag. But maybe I'll get his bag, I don't know. Yeah, get our own logo.
He can sell them to you.
Yeah, that could work.
Well, I was going to take, before we move on, take a quick sponsor break before we get into the show, and thank our sponsors at BDox Timeline 3D for iOS. Incredible guys. Guys, if you don't have this app, now's the time to do it. I just checked. It's on the store for $5. So if you're buying it through the volume purchase program, it's half off. So it's $2.50. It's just for $2.50. The fact that you can get this app for $2.50 is mind blowing, and it kind of shows the power of the app store. Again, timelines are a great tool for telling stories in this historical context. Just want to read you some of the reviews from the app store. I was able to assemble a timeline for a colleague in a matter of minutes, which put his professionally produced timeline to shame. This app helped me clarify and communicate crucial evidence. It's a godsend for me. A must-have for trainers, teachers, speakers, and lecturers. Then David Sparks, our friend over at maxsparky.com, said, it is like magic and makes me look brilliant. So again, if you've not checked out this app, I encourage you to do so. It's bedocs.com, BEEDOCS.com. They make an app for the Mac and for iOS. It's a universal application. The fact that you can get this application for $5 is an absolute steal. And again, if you're going through the volume purchase program, it's $2.50. So thanks to the guys at BDocs for sponsoring Out of School this week.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. So I guess one question is, which case? And the answer is, I honestly don't know. I personally have the Apple Smart Case, which is the sort of smart cover with an actual back on it as well. And I like that in large respect. It's robust. It doesn't come apart. The iPad doesn't fall out of it easily. My biggest complaint about it is that the way that it covers the microphone on the device and the way the material is, that if you are recording on the device and then you sort of shuffle your hands on the case, that sound can be sort of amplified into the microphone quite badly, and it can sort of ruin a recording, which is a bit of a flaw in that case. But apart from that, it's quite nice. One of the nice things about the Smart Case as well is that you can actually get it printed with a custom message on the back, which I only just noticed the other day when we were looking at it in class. So you can get them personalized, probably not personalized, but at least, you know, branded for your school or something like that on the case as well. Of course, the final question, if you go for an Apple case, is going to be, which color can we get? And there are many. There's dark gray, light gray, blue, green, red, and pink, I believe. And you got to be careful with this. And I think the problem, I mean, we had all the girls in the class were like, oh, can I please get a pink one, et cetera, et cetera. None of the boys wanted a pink one, I should say. But the problem is, of course, these cases are going to last for 3 years, and eventually they're going to be recycled to somebody who wasn't the first person who wanted that color. So, for example, if we bought, I don't know, 50 pink cases and 50 red ones, then eventually the gender balance is going to shift a little bit, and you're eventually going to end up with a boy who's got to have a pink case or a girl who's got to have a red case or whatever you decided were the sort of gender-specific ones, and that's going to be a problem. And this is also why we're not going to split 16 gigs and 32 gigs or black and white for different stages of the school, because eventually the balance between those, whatever division you make, whether it's gender or stage or age or something else, that balance is going to shift, and you're not going to have the right balance of devices or cases or whatever anymore. So I think we may get a mixture, but we'll probably avoid the pink, which certain people might not want to have in the future.
Go with the more neutral one.
Yeah. See, the problem we have is that there aren't that many neutral ones, because in Scotland as well, green is Celtic Football Club and blue is Rangers Football Club, and neither the twain shall meet. So perhaps not in our school, but in some schools in Scotland, I guarantee you that if you accidentally sent home a green iPad cover to a Rangers supporting household, or you sent a blue one home to a Celtic supporting household, you would have the most irate parent-teacher conference that you have ever seen in your life. I mean, never mind educational things or behaviour things or anything. The fact that you sent home a blue one to a green household or a green one to a blue household would be a problem as well. So we're basically left with light grey or dark grey or red. So yay for Scotland. What can you say? So there's that. So that's what we're thinking about at the moment. The last question we're kind of trying to deal with is whether we go for 32 gig devices or not. And I did a wee bit of work in this, because one of the things with our refresh right now is that this is going to be our first time that we have got a camera on our iPad. And I think what we're going to see is that people are going to go nuts with that. Certainly for the first year, it's going to be video, video, video all the way. And I had a look at it. I used my iPad Mini as a reference, and I think the fourth generation iPad is similar, but the data rates that come off the camera are pretty substantial. So we were thinking about this and sort of wondering, and let me just see if I can find the actual numbers here. I've got it somewhere. iPad camera data rates. I've got it in a note here. So from the back camera, as you record at 1080p, you're recording 2.1 megabytes per second, which gives you, for a 10-minute video, that's going to eat about 1.2 gigabytes of storage on your device. And the front camera will eat about 780 megabytes for a 10-minute video from the iPad Mini front and back cameras, because obviously the front camera is a 720p camera as well now. So what I did then was I took those videos and I took them into iMovie, and then exported them as the various sizes. Now, iMovie on iOS supports four sizes of export. It supports what they call medium, which is 320p, or 360, I think it is. And that's about 200 megabytes for a 10-minute movie. 540p, which is what they call large, is 330 megabytes per 10 minutes. 720p export is 690 megabytes per 10 minutes. And a 1080p export from iMovie is actually larger than a raw 1080p capture from the camera. It's in my test, was taking about 1.7 gigabytes for a 10-minute 1080p export from iMovie. So there's going to have to be some education there, obviously. But also, this kind of leads me to think, well, you know, if we take those iPads, we put on maybe 4 gigs, 5 gigs of apps, you know, on a 16 gig iPad, that's 10 gigs left. And then you shoot maybe 20, 30 minutes of video, that's another 5 gigs gone. So you're down to 5 gigs spare, and so on and so on. And then maybe you want to put on some iTunes U content that could be cached on the device. And then if you're using, you know, iBooks Author textbooks, which are typically quite chunky as well, suddenly a 16 gig iPad starts to look pretty small. And one of the other things that we're doing for our senior kids next year, we're going to let them put their own apps on the device as well. So we're looking at deploying a certain set of apps, but they're going to deploy additional apps that are going to eat space as well. So we're starting to think that 16 gig iPad is looking a bit tight, at least in the senior school, for what we're going to want to do But of course, like I said earlier, we're not going to split our set between a bigger one for older kids and a smaller one for younger kids, because eventually we'll have to recycle those devices down the years. So I am personally kind of leaning towards going for a 32 gig iPad, because again, you don't know what's going to happen next year and the year after and the year after as well. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about. I continue to hope, and I mean, there's not any rumors at the moment about a new iPad. I've kind of waited for a while in case there's a new iPad is going to come out in March, and it doesn't, obviously March is gone now. It doesn't look like one's coming out in April either. So it does kind of feel like whatever we have right now is what we're going to sign a lease on for 3 years. But I continue to hope that at some point, the 16 gig iPad will just go away, and we'll have a range that is 32, 64, and 128 at the same prices as 16, 32, and 64 are in the line today. Because I think just as apps get bigger for Retina displays and, you know, content gets bigger, high definition movie downloads become a thing, and so on and so on and so on, these cameras keep getting better, that we're just going to, you know, a 16 gig iPad is going to start looking pretty slim for most people's needs. And I'm not even talking about heavy duty users. I mean, it's been interesting to me, I don't know if this is true for you as well, Bradley, but over the last year, one of the things I've dealt with people with iPads more and more and more is my 16 gig iPad is full. And helping them either delete stuff or move up to a bigger iPad has been a common feature of my kind of experience over the past, I would say, 10 to 12 months.
No, yeah. And the thing about it is you're better to make the decision now at 32 and not need it than buy 16 and then need it, because you can't really go back and fix it. One of the things that I run into a lot with you know, not necessarily at work, but just in out in, you know, my daily travels, is people filling up their iPhones and iPads with their camera roll, where they're just taking, you know, movie after movie after movie. You know, they have 2 years worth of photos on their iPhone. Every iPhone photo they've ever taken is still on the camera roll. And then it says that, you know, you can take no more pictures, and say, well, you need to get them off. And they say, well, I thought I had iCloud. And this is where it's like really tough for Apple to explain like what iCloud is. And then I have to explain to them, well, iCloud is to be able to back up, but it's not really meant to be a long-term storage. And that's an opportunity for Apple, I really think. That's really the one thing you still need a Mac for. I mean, if it wasn't for having to manage my photo library, I think I could go without a Mac at all in my life. But I've got 60 gigs of photos, and Apple doesn't really have a service that's, you know, set up to deal with those like they do iTunes Match or, you know, anything else. So, no, I really think you're making the right decision if you go to 32, because you just don't know. If you break it down on, I mean, here's what I would do, is I would get two quotes. One that shows me my lease payment on 16 gigs, and one that shows me my lease payment on 32 gigs. And I think when you break it down, like on your actual lease payments, it's not that much difference.
Yeah, well, we actually did that. And the way we work it is we look at the cost per pupil per month over the period as a fraction of our overall kind of monthly budget per pupil. And I think if I remember right, the sort of average difference between going 8 gigs or 16 gigs, sorry, and 32 gigs was about between £2 and £2.50 per pupil per month. So you're not looking at a massive difference either way. It's a fraction more per pupil, and then obviously you multiply that up by the number of pupils. But as we've always said, you know, the most expensive deployment is the one that doesn't do the job you want it to do. So it seems to me likely that we're probably going to go for 32.
I really agree with you and hope that kind of that shift happens. But Apple has held the line on that really since 2007. Well, I guess the original one, they had a 4 and an 8. Was it the 3G that started at 16?
I had a 4 gig iPhone the first original iPhone. I had a 4 gigabyte one. And then they went to 8, 16, 32, and now 64s, obviously.
This is why we need a chat room.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly when that first came out, but I remember, you know, 32 gig iPhone was amazing.
Oh, here it is. The 3G capacity was 8 gigabyte or 16 gigabyte. So it must have been the 3GS.
was the first 32. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I still have one of those in the house somewhere.
So that was in 2009. Well, no, I'm looking here, and it's saying that this had an 8, a 16, and a 32.
Yeah, the 8 gig models didn't go away until a bit later on. Was it the iPhone 4 that was the first?
I guess it had to be. But it just seems, you know, their memory prices have fallen off the cliff in some ways, and I just don't think that they would affect their margins that great to drop that down. And I probably would be more inclined to move up to the 64 gig on my iPhone, because then I could keep my entire music collection locally on the phone and not have to deal with iTunes Match.
Yeah, and I think it's this is kind of the we've mentioned this before in the show, but to me this is like the next frontier of iOS deployment in schools, is working out what the long-term data workflow is. I mean, we've kind of bumped along from year to year, basically kind of like resetting people's iPads every year, and I think more and more that's not really going to fly, and I think we're going to have to work out what is the long-term strategy for all the data you're going to generate as you go through the school. And ideally, it's going to be something that the pupil can take with them when they leave school, as well as, you know, move on from year to year within the school. I don't have a really good solution for that yet. A lot of people have presented me different solutions. None of them I'm absolutely delighted with, but I think that's going to be, like, if there's something I want to see develop over the next 3 years, the first 3 years were all about getting the device to be faster and getting more applications on the platform and more capabilities on the platform. But now I think it's really sort of polishing off those last corners. iOS 5 made a huge step forward when it sort of cut the cord from the Mac, if you like, for activation and backup and so on. And I think the next few years to me really look like how does one become a person who only has an iPad but still has a kind of fully rounded computer experience with backup and you know, year upon year upon year of data growth, and have that supported while still not having to kind of fall back to a Mac for some of that stuff. And that, like you said, with the photo stuff, and that's the biggest one, because they are generally like the biggest permanent chunks of data on your device. Those are still the ones that I think people are bumping into corners with. And I guess one thing that some people are doing is they're just, you know, every time they hit that limit, they just get a bigger iPad the next time they upgrade, and next time and next time. But it would seem weird to end up, you know, like with a terabyte iPad just in order to store your photos, whereas we could do something with the cloud in that respect as well.
It'll be neat when your students that started out in your lowest grade with an iPad, when they actually graduate, and you can say this is the first group that went iPad all the way through.
Yeah, they're going to be a whole different generation of people. And it's funny, I've kind of been, trolling is putting it too sophisticated away, but I was pointing out on Twitter, I guess, that, you know, one of the constant criticisms over iPad, stronger back in the day, but, you know, still people come out with it, is that when people leave school, they're going to have to walk into a business running Windows XP. And if you don't know Windows XP on the first day, you're never going to get a job. And one of the things I can be pointing out on Twitter is that various stories of companies who have kind of gone over to iPad for a lot of the work they do with the computers. The first example was American Airlines. One of the American carriers, I think it was American Airlines, who have replaced basically the pilot's flight case full of paper books with an iPad that's mounted on the dashboard in the cockpit of their planes. You know, iPad computer business. And the second one was the construction company Balfour Beatty, who, instead of using paper and laptops for their construction plans on sites for big projects, they're giving out iPads to their supervisors now, so that they're carrying around the construction plans. And they found that the number of bits of rework that they have to do once they've built the structure is actually way down, because they're carrying live copies of the plans instead of outdated paper copies and then making mistakes from old plans and so on. So it's an interesting future. And I think by the time most of our kids get to the workforce, you know, if the workforce is still using Windows XP at that point, that's not a company they should be joining, I don't think.
Well, and my thing that I preach to our teachers and to our, you know, administration is we need to be teaching kids fundamentals of technology, to where if they did only know the iPad, they could sit down, like, and let's say they did go to a job that only used Windows 11. they should have the fundamental skills to be able to operate in that environment.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Windows 8, for example, explain to me how kids who were taught Windows XP all through school are going to suddenly be wizards in Windows 8. They're clearly not, right? But they are going to have to be adaptable. And I think the very world that we live in right now, which is, let's face it, a multi-platform world, you know, there's Macs, there's Windows PCs, there's Android phones, there's iPhones, there's iPad tablets, you know, and let's face it, there's games consoles as well. Those are just different operating systems that are worked in a different way. And then every website in the world has got a different user interface as well. So people are much more adept today at moving between different user interfaces than they were before. This isn't the same generation as it was in 1984 when Apple came out with a very consistent, rigid user interface that always worked exactly the same way because that was all people could cope with to understand this new computer paradigm. People have been brought up in a world of lots and lots of different user interfaces and are much more adept at moving between them than before. I think, anyway.
I agree. I used Office 97 and Windows, I guess, 98 in high school. I mean, how is that still relevant today?
Indeed. Let me tell you about one other thing that kind of comes out of this project, which is something that I haven't really mentioned on Twitter. I haven't blogged about it yet, although I'm going to. And this is kind of the first mention of something that we're doing at Cedars over the summer term, which is we're going to take some of the iPads that are coming off the lease that we're going to buy out because we're on this finance lease at the moment. And so we can kind of take title of those iPads for a low amount of money. We're connected with another teacher in another school in the town who is married to a guy from Rwanda, and she and he run a charity in Rwanda called Aid for Education. And what they have out there is they have, it's one organization, but there's two different sites in a town called Ramagana, which is about an hour to the northeast of the capital of Rwanda, Kigali. We're going to go to those schools. We're going to take some of our senior pupils and about six teachers and helpers from the school, and we're going to take some of our iPads with us, and we are going to take that equipment and the expertise, and Aerohive are actually going to help us with some Wi-Fi kit as well, and we are going to go to those schools and we're going to help set them up basically as a kind of small-scale iPad school in Rwanda as well. That is my summer project right there.
That'll be exciting.
It will be. Yeah, we've been kind of working on the fundraising for it for a while. And if I may be so bold as to say that we'll put a link in the show notes to our fundraising page. And if anybody who this podcast has helped or my blog has helped or would care to help us do this project, we'd really appreciate any help that people could give. That would be fantastic. We'll put a link to the Just Giving page for that in the show notes, if that's okay. So basically the plan is that we're going in June. We're going to take about 20 iPads, I think. There's a couple going to a sort of farming collective in the town, and then the rest are going to the school. We're going to set that up for them. We're going to take ourselves some Ethernet cable and some base stations, and we're going to set up a Wi-Fi network for them. They have internet access there. My understanding is that they have a kind of 3G dongle system that goes into a computer. So hopefully we'll be able to kind of bridge that with the Aerohive equipment so that we can their network can have 3G internet access. We'll probably lean on some of the data throttling features in Aerohive to keep the cost down on that as well, because that'll be a factor too. But we're just going to see how that goes. I guess most of my time, we're going to be out there for 2 weeks, most of my time will be spent kind of dealing with the technical side of things and getting people up to speed so that they're self-sustaining to manage that after we're gone. But there's other teachers that are going to be doing other things as well. So there's going to be some construction projects and some various other things as we go.
I went to Africa a few years ago, and it's interesting to see the differences in cellular technology from country to country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't have all that much information about it just yet. I'm supposed to be getting some more information quite soon, but I'll certainly keep people posted as we go. And maybe I might even record a couple of things while I'm out there, and we'll stick them out as additional episodes once we get back. But that's the project that we're involved in at the moment. It's something that we'll do this year. I don't know that we'll do exactly the same thing again in a few years' time, particularly not if we go into this operating lease model where we would have to pay a lot of money to buy those iPads and take them somewhere again. Whereas because we've basically paid off the iPads by the summertime, we'll be able to buy them for a nominal price that we can basically afford out of our pocket, and take those iPads with us and send them to schools that are in substantially more deprived areas than Greenock, and help get them set up as well. So that's kind of where I'm at the moment with that. I'll say more about that on the show as we kind of develop what we're doing technology-wise with that. At the moment, we've just been working on fundraising mostly. I mentioned the technology drive that we've done before. We've got a Just Giving webpage. We've done a whole series of other events in the school as well. And we're just about 70% of the way to our funding target to make it all happen. But we're pretty excited about it. I should add that I really claim no credit in inventing this thing. This was not my idea at all. This was our art teacher, Jenny Oakley. It was all her idea. And maybe we'll get her on the show at some point to explain herself and how she ended up dragging us all to Africa. But it was all her idea, and I'm just kind of tagging on as the guy who's going to make the technology work. But she's the one who's really had the vision for the whole thing and driven it and organized fundraising and badgered everybody to publicize it and so on. And she's persuaded me to keep mentioning it on the show, and eventually I'm going to blog about it and tell most of the story there, both before and after we go. So we're pretty excited about it. We go at the start of June. We're going to be gone for 2 weeks, and we're taking most of our senior school, which is about 12, 13, 14 kids at the moment, and six teachers. We'll be gone for 2 weeks, and that will be our just 2 weeks before the end of the term, before the summer, and it's going to be pretty exciting. I think it's I've been to Africa once before. I did some consulting work with a school in Zambia, the American International School in Lusaka there, and obviously every country in Africa is different in many ways, but Rwanda is obviously got its history, and I think we're going to learn quite a lot about that as well. We're keeping our eye on the travel advisory. It's interesting, you know, people, when you say to people you're going to Rwanda, they're sort of horrified because of the history of, you know, the genocide and stuff that happened in the 90s there. But if you look at the travel advisory from the UK government, Rwanda is considered no more dangerous to go and visit than Mexico, for example. And nobody's horrified when you go on holiday to Mexico.
Well, I don't know about that. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, I've been to Africa once back in, I guess it was 2011, and I went to Uganda for about 10 days. And I'll tell you what we did for internet access is we, you know, one of the things that's interesting, and I think we've even mentioned this on a past show, is like over in a lot of countries that are still developing, they're really not putting in wired infrastructure. Everything is over cellular. So, you know, it can be like, you know, a really, really small town, and every store is like an Orange Minute reseller. It's very much they don't really do contracts. They didn't in Uganda. So what we did is I went on there on a mission trip, and we went and rented a Orange cellular USB card, plugged it into a Mac, and they did internet sharing, because you can do USB to Wi-Fi and share the internet connection. And then we would, you know, anybody, whoever, kind of donated money towards the you know, data allowance got the SSID passcode, and that was really nice. We were actually like in the banana plantations and were Skyping back home.
Awesome. I've actually heard stories of kids in the UK doing that just to get proper internet access in their school as well. A friend of mine told me that he uncovered a sort of circle of boys in one of his schools where they had basically been clubbing together their money and buying a MiFi, a little, you know, a 3G to Wi-Fi dongle thing. And they were carrying that about to their classes so that they could get on the proper internet in their school. Which is a red flag to your school internet, I think. But there we go. So yeah, we'll keep people informed of that as well. We'll hopefully have some things to report before we go, and also after we come back, and possibly while we're there if we can get the bandwidth. And we'd love, if MD can support us in that with fundraising, we would love that, but we'll just keep letting you know what's going on with that as well. So we'll put some links in the show notes for that, and we'll keep pushing on that until it happens.
That sounds exciting. Again, if you want to donate, the link will be in the show notes. If you use a podcasting app on the iPhone or Android, it should have the link in there you can click on. If you're using Apple's podcast app, you probably can't see the link, so go to outofschool.net. And this is episode 31 if you're listening after the fact. So again, it's a worthy cause to contribute towards.
Yeah, it feels good to be able to kind of pass it on as well. You know, it's at some level, sometimes these projects get criticized as the playthings of rich private schools, you know, and I think it's never been our intention to keep it to ourselves. And we've obviously always been very free with sharing as much knowledge as we've gained from the project that we've done, but also it feels good to actually be able to share the devices as well and put them in the hands of people who can really make good use of them. I think that's all we've got to talk about today.
Yeah, I've got about 20 iPads to update. These point upgrades to iOS are killing me.
Yeah, you should have been doing it a few years ago.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, you think you've got it bad right now? I guess the nicest thing about current iOS update technology is that you can just press a button and walk away. You know, you don't have to. I remember doing the upgrade from iOS, what would that have been? iOS 4 to 5, perhaps? There was one that came along where basically it would wipe the entire device and then do the OS upgrade and then resync everything, including all the apps. And it was taking me, because iTunes can't, unlike Configurator, iTunes can't or couldn't at the time update the operating system concurrently on multiple devices. It could sync them multiply, but it couldn't update the OS on more than one at a time. And it was taking me an hour per device across the whole school, and that nearly had me switching to Windows laptops. Anything was better than that.
Yeah, because
those days are behind us.
Yeah, that would have been bad. I did 4 to 5, but we didn't have this many iPads at this point. But because for some reason I can't get Configurator to do the point upgrades. Like I plug it up and I hit update and it tells me it's up to date and it just doesn't work. So, But you're right. It's just a set it and forget it. And thankfully the 6.1.3 has been out for, I guess, 2 weeks at this point. So it's actually already downloaded it. So I don't even have to download it. I just hit the install button.
Yeah, it'll cache it in the background and then it'll tell you that it's ready, which is quite nicely done.
Yeah, the only thing I wish is I could put a passcode where if you were in a situation where you knew that something was going to break an app that you used every day in all your classrooms, like that would be a shame if a kid updated accidentally. I don't know. I wish there would be some way like you could kind of keep track of that.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. I think obviously there's a difference between if you deploy apps through Configurator, talking about apps here rather than OS, but Configurator-based deployed apps have to come back to Configurator to get an update, whereas apps that are deployed on the device can be updated through the App Store directly. So that was actually described to me as a feature because it meant that your key teaching apps could be stably upgraded in larger chunks rather than just everybody randomly bumping them up to the next level. And I can sort of buy that. Yeah, I can see that too.
All right, well, good show.
Good luck with your updates then.
Thanks. I did some this morning and it took me 20 minutes to do about 20 of them. So I've got 20 more to do this afternoon. So I'm hoping 20 minutes and I'm out the door.
I guess this is update week all in. We started talking about Hive Manager and now we're talking about iOS. We're going to upgrade our Wi-Fi on a Thursday and we'll see how that goes too.
So if I don't hear from you, I know that the Wi-Fi died.
Yeah, if I never come back to the internet, that's why. I'll be stuck in a room getting fed flat food until I fix it. Yeah, that's going to be me. Anyway, let's wrap it up there.
All right.
Pleasure as always to talk to you, Bradley.
You as well.
Let's do the URLs. We haven't done that in a while. Spears.org, SPEIRS.org for my blog. Fraser Spears on Twitter. We'll put a link to our Rwanda Just Giving page in the show notes. And where can people find you, Bradley?
On the web at chambersdaily.com and then at Bradley Chambers on Twitter.
Awesome. We'll talk to you next time, everybody.
Have a good week.